Well, I had no idea, none of us. I was just talking to Demi Moore. This is one of the unfortunate things about working with young talent. You know, you take these needy young actors who need a job, you give them a job in a movie,
give
and
them a
then
body.
You buy them shoes and they walk all over you. Look at that. Oh, God, he's still my heart. Right. The lovely Chris O'Donnell. He was nothing till I found him.
Always entertaining being on a set with Joel. I mean, it is always a great ride.
I freeze. I'm Batman.
You're not sending me to the cooler.
I think that Joel is extremely unique because he creates an atmosphere that does not make you feel like you're in a movie set. Because he makes everyone feel like we're all working together. There's no one above and there's no one below and there's no one over here and over there. We all are one team. And he creates this atmosphere so that you're looking forward to coming to the set, although you have to go through the makeup and carry around this heavy armor. But you're looking forward to come to the set and just to be with him and with his team that makes you feel so comfortable and makes you feel at home, no matter what the scene is, if it's a difficult scene or an easy scene.
I grew up at a time where there really was in a movie colony at all in New York. There really still isn't. Los Angeles was a far piece away, especially for a poor kid in the streets of New York. And so I didn't think it was possible to get into the movie business.
After making and losing a fortune in the clothing business in the 60s, Joel Schumacher entered the film industry as a costume designer. But his desire to become a director led him to writing, which he felt was the quickest way to occupying a director's chair. Schumacher's first attempt at screenwriting was sold to ABC Television as a movie of the week, but was never produced. His next effort, titled Sparkle, was filmed by Warner Brothers in 1976 under the direction of first-time director Sam Osteen. In that same year, Joel wrote the hit film Car Wash, and in 1978, The Wiz. His writing did eventually bring him his first directing assignment, which turned out to be the 1974 television movie The Virginia Hill Story, starring Diane Cannon and Robbie Benson.
I didn't like the way I directed The Virginia Hill Story. I was under the illusion that since I had wanted to be a director ever since I was a child, that I had a great calling to do this. And so when I started directing, I thought I'd be a genius, and I really, really wasn't. And I thought I needed to learn more before I directed again. And of course, writing movies and working on other directors' movies helped me enormously in the learning process. It was time for me to take some time to learn and not direct again.
5 years would pass before Schumacher would direct again. The opportunity came in 1979 when he directed yet another TV movie titled Amateur Night at the Dixie Bar and Grill, with a very young cast, many of whom went on to successful movie careers.
I just want to make it clear, I made Joel Schumacher what he is today. I was in Amateur Night at the Dixie Bar and Grill in 1978, a TV movie. So now it's 1994, I guess I worked on Batman Forever, so He has a pretty ironclad rule. Once every 17 years, he uses me in a film. He was great in 1978, but he has learned and done other things that have made him the great feature director he is now. You know, he was a writer who wanted to do this TV movie, and it was a terrific script, and so he got very good people in it. I mean, there's an actor who was not known that well then by the name of Dennis Quaid, who was in it. Don Johnson is in it. I'm in it. Candy Clark is in it. Victor French and Tanya Tucker. An incredible cast in that TV movie.
Back then, it was obvious that Joel was going to, you know, be a force as a director, I think. He was... He had such a controlled sort of glee, it seemed, about directing. Really found a real enjoyment about it and was infectious with everyone else.
Joel's first feature film for theaters, The Incredible Shrinking Woman, was released in 1981 and starred Lily Tomlin, Ned Beatty, Henry Gibson, Charles Grodin, and Sally Kirkland. Tomlin played a woman who shrinks after being exposed to a bizarre mixture of household chemicals.
The Incredible Shrinking Woman starred Lily Tomlin, and I thought it would be fun because, you know, she's such a brilliant comic talent. And I thought the idea of big sets and the comic book, the cartoon of it, would be fun to do. It was way too ambitious a project for a first movie. I mean, I was coming off a 19-day television movie, and I suddenly went into special effects hell. Lily Tomlin and her partner Jane Wagner and I really didn't see eye to eye on a lot of things, and although they were very kind to give me my first opportunity, I think in the long run they either should have gone off to make their movie or I should have gone off to make my movie, because I think a lot of the way we made the film was to compromise with each other, and I'm not so sure that's always the best way to make a film.
In 1983, Joel co-wrote and directed DC Cab. It was a campy look at a bunch of misfits who drive cabs in the nation's capital. Many of the cast members were comedians, which made for a lively time on the set.
I did a better job with DC Cab than I did with Incredible Shrinking Woman. I think it was a small, much smaller film, a lot easier to control. I think because of Car Wash, I felt very comfortable with the material, and I got a wonderful cast. You can't not have a good time when you're making a movie with comedians, because I think they're in competition to top each other all the time. So we had very tough conditions, very short shooting schedule, no money, but a lot of fun.
In 1985, Schumacher would release St. Elmo's Fire, a film he co-wrote as well as directed. The movie would introduce to the world such rising stars as Demi Moore, Emilio Estevez, Rob Lowe, Judd Nelson, Ally Sheedy, Andy McDowell, and Mayor Winningham. For better or worse, the group became known as the Brat Pack.
St. Elmo's Fire came about because while I was doing DC Cab, I lived in Georgetown. And what I realized in Georgetown in the early 80s was it kind of was a city of yuppies. It was a Disneyland of yuppiedom, and how immature and young people still are when they come out of college. So I wanted to do a story about a group of friends who had gone through the college experience together and realized when they got into real life that there were a lot of cold, hard facts they weren't willing or hadn't been used to dealing with. And that's how St. Elmo's Fire was born. Thank you, God.
What are we going to do about your extracurricular love life? Huh?
What extracurricular love life?
Oh, come on.
What did Kevin tell you?
Nothing.
Did you tell him?
He told me nothing. It was just a hunch. Until now.
I was just talking to Demi Moore a few weeks ago, And we were talking about how we still get asked questions about St. Elmo's Fire. And she said, did you have any idea when we were doing it that it would be this famous? And she said, no, we didn't know what we were doing. I said, I know, I didn't know what I was doing.
Schumacher's 1987 release of The Lost Boys was about teenage vampires. Joel explained the film to Warner Brothers executives as being both a comedy and a horror movie, a combination that made the executives nervous but proved very successful with movie-going audiences.
Along came Mr. Richard Donner, a great friend of mine. Dick was going to do The Lost Boys after Goonies. And I think he got cold feet and also fell in love, lucky him, with Lethal Weapon, and was going off to do Lethal Weapon with Mel and Danny. And so he asked me if I would take The Lost Boys. And I read it and I was going to say no, because basically it was about nine-year-olds. There were no girls in it. It was very G-rated. It was very much Goonies Go Vampire.
The characters in it were written to be quite young, younger than I was at 19 at the time when I did it. They were supposed to be like 13, 14 years old. And Joel had really restructured not only just in the casting, but the piece by the time we actually went to shoot it. Because I think in the hands of anybody else, if they had just made the script they had, it would not have been an interesting film on really any level.
Then I went in and I said, I'd like to do this, but not this script. You know, why couldn't the Lost Boys be teenagers, and why couldn't they ride motorcycles, and why? And they said, oh, great, just do it. Just make it.
You afraid to face me, David? Huh?
Tried to make you immortal.
You tried to make me a killer! You are a killer.
Once again, we really didn't know what we were doing, and we made up an awful lot of it on the spot. Jeff Boehm did a wonderful job with the script and the rewrites, but a lot of the jokes in the movie and a lot of the inside humor was made up on the spot by the cast and me, or the crew, and we were kind of finding it as we were making it. Once again, not knowing that the movie would be as successful as it was. Mark Cannon, who was running Warner Brothers then, used to come and see me from time to time and say, you know, the heads of the studio, Bob and Terry, are a little worried, Joel, are you making a comedy or a horror movie? And I'd say, yes. And there was a worry that the two genres wouldn't go together.
Hello?
Sam, is everything all right?
Mom, I think we have to have a real long talk about something. Nothing.
Listen, just who's making that noise?
Mom, I can't talk about it on the phone. It's about Michael.
Don't listen to him, Mom. He doesn't know what he's saying. Sam doesn't know what he's saying.
Oh!
Shut up, Sam.
Mom, help! He's gonna get me!
Oh, my God!
Sam! Mom! He's gonna kill me!
Honey, I'm coming!
No, get away!
Stay back!
Sammy, help me! Open up! Help me! Sammy, open the window!
Never! I knew it!
I am not!
So where are you? The boy, none!
It's really a pop film. I mean, it's not a real heavy thing, but Joel has a wonderful talent in helping actors try and find something a little deeper in anything they're doing, and is very articulate in those ways.
I think I probably answer more questions in interviews about The Lost Boys than almost any other movie, because it seemed to have had enormous staying power and a huge cult following. I'm very proud of that. I'm proud that people enjoyed it so much.
Roger Ebert wrote of Schumacher's 1989 release of Cousins, "The movie is intelligently directed by Joel Schumacher. This isn't one of those shallow movies. It gets inside the lives of these people." Fortunately, audiences reacted the same way, and the chemistry created on screen by Ted Danson and Isabella Rossellini made for one of 1989's most popular films.
You know, there's a very, very delicate balance to Cousins, because first of all, you have a leading man who isn't ambitious, who doesn't want success, who doesn't care how much money he makes. He just wants to be happy and to have a loving relationship. You know, before Ted Danson became a big television star, he had a very small role in The Onion Field. And then he was a ruthless lawyer in Body Heat. And he did a Fred Astaire tap dance on a dock in Body Heat. And he had this wonderful, lanky body. And I just thought he would be a wonderful combination with Isabella Rossellini, because, you know, she has this beautiful European, Scandinavian mystery and beauty and elegance, and I thought he was such an American that they would be very sexy and very charming and very lovable together.
My husband and my daughter need me.
And us?
Us? Well, we do what generally people do. Go on with their lives. Many people aren't supposed to be happy.
No, I don't believe that.
I came to say goodbye.
I know.
Today's a good day to die.
Schumacher's 1990 production of the offbeat film Flatliners featured medical students who explore the realm of near-death experiences, hoping to gain insights into the phenomenon. The young cast included Kiefer Sutherland, Kevin Bacon, and Julia Roberts.
I felt that Flatliners was a tremendous leap for the audience. You know, they had to go with us on an incredible journey. And I wanted to do everything to assist that journey, and I thought we should give it a very surreal, very gothic theater.
And I walked on the set the first time, and I saw these huge gothic walls and the Statue of Liberty's head in the corner, and a gurney over a grate with steam coming through it, and Jan de Bont had done all of this light magic that it looked like the stage for an AC/DC concert. It did not look anything like what I had thought in my head, and I panicked, and I went, I can't do this, no, I can't do this.
You know, he wanted bigger images, images of death. You know, it's a very kind of gothic feel in the sets and the locations, and there's a kind of this kind of style to the whole thing. You know, there's a hipness in the way that the people look and the move and the way the whole thing is done.
Nothing. Starting CPR. 1-1000, 2-1000, 3-1000, 4-1000, 5-1000.
Breathe.
CPR and adrenaline and nothing.
145.
What's going on here? Come on, Joel. 3-1000. Come on, Nelson, let me try.
5-1000, breathe.
We're running out of time.
2-1000, 3-1000. Come on, Nelson, let me try. Doing everything I fucking can. Breathe.
Let him try.
Nelson, step back.
Come on, Joe. 1-1000, 2-1000, 3-1000, 4-1000.
I remember one day we were all talking about the end of the movie, and Julia Roberts said, "Guys, let's face it, we have no end for this movie." So once again, I had a spectacular cast that took a chance with me on, you know, sailing into out there where there's nothing and trying to get back.
He said two of the things that I've never forgotten that are very, very important. He said, "I don't know if another director's ever told you this, but I take it very personally that your career is in my hands. And the second thing he said was, and you're going to have to trust me.
Schumacher felt he missed the mark in his 1991 production of Dying Young, starring Julia Roberts and Campbell Scott. The downbeat story of a young man who is dying from blood cancer was not received well by either critics or moviegoers.
Joel sent me the script, I read it, and liked it immediately. It was mysterious, intelligent, not predictable, not safe, risky, in other words. Characters had many different dimensions to them. They don't behave along one line all the time. Do you know anything about chemotherapy?
Well, I know it's a treatment for...
And they give me a course of it every time I fail their blood test. It's pretty... Well, I need help during it. Want the job?
Make it sound so attractive.
In retrospect, I think I was attracted to Dying Young for all the wrong reasons, and I don't think I was the best director for it, and I don't know if I did the best job I could have done. I don't think if anyone else had given me that script, I would have said yes, but I was so in love with Julia, and to know her is to love her, and I learned a painful lesson, and maybe she did too. You don't do a movie because you're in love with the star. You do a movie because you're in love with the movie. And I'm proud of it because I think that Campbell Scott and Julia are wonderful in it.
Ripped from the headlines of just about any newspaper in the country, Falling Down, starring Michael Douglas, struck a positive chord with audiences all across the country. Released in 1993, the film proved to be one of Schumacher's biggest hits up to that time.
One soda, 12 ounces, 50 cents, sold. Pleasure frequenting your establishment.
I thought it was such a good script, and it had the action. It had an opportunity to initiate action, and that was the principal reason why I took the role of defense.
The scariest part of the movie was when we first showed it to an audience, and the marketing people at Warner Brothers had said, you know, you're going to get from 60 to 80 to 100 walkouts because people will not tolerate this kind of, you know, politically incorrect tone in a film, right? No one left. They cheered. When he took out the Uzi in the Whammy Burger, which is my favorite scene in the movie, there was pandemonium in the theater. And it's exciting as a filmmaker to create that kind of response.
That's not our policy. You have to order something from the lunch menu.
I don't want lunch. I want breakfast.
Yeah, well, hey, I'm really sorry.
Yeah, well, hey, I'm really sorry, too.
Jason!
Get organized!
Calm down. Just calm down, everybody. Sit down. Sit down over there.
Hey. Mister. Where are you going? No. You sit down there and you finish your lunch. Come on. Everybody just relax and... Take it easy. Come on. Why don't you eat your lunch, please? Eat your lunch. You'll need your vitamins A's and B's and...
No, it's an accident. It's the trigger. It's sensitive. It's okay. It's all right. It's a sensitive trigger.
This man is nuts. He is out of his mind.
Not anybody I know stops his car on a freeway, in a highway, in traffic, and walks away from his car.
Michael Douglas and I for not one minute thought he was the good guy. We always knew he was the bad guy. He's a man who winds up on the end of a pier waving a loaded gun at his ex-wife and child. So we never thought he was the good guy. Michael really let all his flaws show, and he let me cut off his magnificent hair, and he was not shy about doing the role. And unfortunately, with Falling Down, because Michael's performance is so brilliant and so flashy, so theatrical and so stimulating, Robert Duvall gets overlooked a lot of the time, and it's really the story of two men. And Robert Duvall is equally brilliant in a very restrained, very subtle performance.
Hey, Sandra! I know who this guy is!
Who is he?
He had this personalized license plate. What the hell was it? It was weird. It said, defense.
Defense?
D-F-E-N-S. Defense. And he said he was on his way home. Go check out his address.
Okay.
Yo, Mr. Yee. Defense.
Schumacher brought John Grisham's novel, The Client, to the screen in 1994 with a powerful cast that included Susan Sarandon, Tommy Lee Jones, Anthony LaPaglia, and newcomer Brad Renfro.
Brad Pitt and I were going to do a movie called The Devil's Advocate, which is being shot now with Keanu Reeves and Al Pacino, about a young man who goes to work for a law firm that's run by the devil. And we had a wonderful cast, a wonderful crew, a wonderful cinematographer, a wonderful production designer, and Barbara Ling, and a bad script that wasn't ready to make. And we were getting a lot of pressure to start the movie. And by then I had worked with so many young actors and actresses who were in the same position Brad was at that moment, which was right on the cusp, where everyone was talking about Brad Pitt, but he needed it. He was sort of one movie away from big stardom. And although in the past I had been very, even though I'd had maybe thin scripts or strange projects like Flatliners, I'd always been able to say to the young actors and actresses, trust me, we're going to be okay. And I sat Brad down and I said, Brad, I can't say that to you, and you're at too crucial a stage in your career for me to ask you to take a chance on this material, because we're not there yet. So we aborted the project, and the minute I aborted the project, Arnon Milchan called me and said that he had just bought the rights to John Grisham's new novel, The Client. Could I read the 800 pages of Galleys that night and let him know first thing in the morning whether I would do it or not? So I got the 800 pages of Galleys and was hooked from the very opening scene, which is a great movie scene. Then once again, I got one of the great casts. I got the incredible Susan Sarandon to play Reggie Love, and Tommy Lee Jones to play the Reverend Roy Foltrie.
Joel did an excellent job of casting real actors to bring to it all kinds of flavors and colors and depths that maybe, you know, didn't have to be there.
And through the help of a police officer in Knoxville, Tennessee, found Brad Renfro, and he's only 10 years old in The Client, and he is staggering.
If you was my lawyer and I told you something, could you ever repeat it?
No. What is it you want to tell me?
Well, that Clifford guy came driving up in his big black car, and me and Ricky, we snuck up to watch. And that Clifford guy got out, and he put a gun in his mouth, and he blew the back of his head out.
You're right. You do need a lawyer, Mark Sway. There are a few male lawyers down the hall. You want me to recommend one?
How many cases have you won?
More than I lost.
How much do you cost?
How much you got?
Mm-hmm.
working with Joel itself was a delight. I like to think of directors and ask myself what it is about them I like. What particular thing makes them who they are, in my opinion. Now, I've only worked with Joel once, but Joel to me is one of the most imaginative directors in Hollywood, and I learned so much just watching how that man, you know, through his own wicked wit, makes us all somewhat witty and better than we were.
Judge Roosevelt.
As for you, Mr. Foltrig, this is not New Orleans, and I'm not one of your federal judges. This is my private courtroom, and I make the rules. Rule number one, you will speak only when spoken to. Rule number two, do not grace his honor with unsolicited commentary. Rule number three, his honor does not like to listen to the voices of U.S. attorneys who love to hear themselves speak. Do you understand these rules, gentlemen?
You know, I said when we were kind of doing the last draft, you know, we can't waste Tommy Lee. He's just the best. We have to find more for us to do. And so every opportunity we got, we played a little with each other. And I think that it works pretty well.
As Mr. Foltrig has done so thorough a job in attempting to implicate Mark, I must, out of an abundance of caution, advise my client to take the Fifth.
Haven't we played enough games here? Your Honor, we are all searchers for the truth. A man has been murdered, and another man lies dead by his own hand, yet this boy remains silent. What wanton hubris is this? Speak, child, now. Lying lips are an abomination to the Lord. So saith the psalm.
That's Proverbs 12:22. This is still a courtroom, not a church, Mr. Foltrig.
I think some really great things happened, and certainly this is the kind of film where that would pay off. You know, I adore him, and I think that he got wonderful performances out of just everyone.
In 1994, Schumacher inherited the Batman series from director Tim Burton. Audiences went wild for Joel's 1995 release of Batman Forever, which starred Val Kilmer as Batman, along with actors Tommy Lee Jones, Jim Carrey, Nicole Kidman, and Chris O'Donnell.
Your entrance was good, his was better.
I was just about to shoot The Client in Memphis, Tennessee. I was about a week away from shooting, and I got a call from Bob Daly and Terry Semel's offices, who run our esteemed, I call them the brothers. It's Warner Brothers, so we must have brothers. So we have Bob and Terry. And they said they were sending one of the Warner private planes to pick me up in Memphis because they wanted to have breakfast with me. So I thought something very important was up, or I was going to be fired. But maybe if you're getting fired, they don't send the plane. Maybe they send the Greyhound bus. Of course, they were offering me the Batman franchise. I actually didn't know it was the corporation's largest asset. And Tim Burton and I are friends, and I said, look, I will not do it if Tim Burton doesn't want me to do it, because we're friends and he created it. And so I went to see Tim to have lunch with him, and he was thrilled I was going to do it, because I think after Batman Returns, Tim didn't want to do any more Batman movies. So I said yes. Then I woke up in the middle of the night and thought, oh my God, what have I done? This could fail so miserably, and it will be such a public failure. And Tim is considered such a great artist, and what have you done? And then on top of it, I changed Batman from Michael Keaton to Val Kilmer.
Hot entrance. I'm Chase Meridian.
I asked Dr. Meridian to come to Gotham to consult on this case. She specializes in
abnormal psychology, multiple personalities. I read your work. Insightful. Naive, but insightful.
I'm flattered. Not every girl makes a superhero's night table.
Can we reason with him? He's holding innocent people up there.
It won't do any good. He'll slaughter them without thinking twice.
Agreed. A trauma powerful enough to create an alternate personality leaves the victim
in a world where normal rules of right and wrong no longer apply.
Exactly.
Like you. Well, let's just say I could write a hell of a paper on a grown man who dresses like a flying rodent.
Bats aren't rodents, Dr. Meridian.
Really? I didn't know that.
You are interesting. And call me Chase.
It was a it was just a great deal of fun to be a comic book character. I mean, ordinarily I look for certain subtleties that a comic book doesn't concern itself with. So it was liberating, of course, to be a comic book villain.
Luck! Blind, stupid, simple, doodah, clueless! Luck! The wrath of Toss. I only drew justice. Let's see what justice has in store for you.
I mean, it's great to be a part of, you know, the Batman movies. It's such an American icon now. and I wanted to work with Joel Schumacher, the director. And obviously it was such a great cast with Val Kilmer and Jim Carrey and Tommy Lee and Chris O'Donnell that it was pretty hard to resist.
Last night at the bank, I noticed something about Two-Face. His coin. It's his Achilles heel. It can be exploited.
I know. You called me here for this. The bat signal is not a beeper.
Well, I wish I could say that my interest in you was purely professional.
You're trying to get under my cape, Doctor?
A girl can't live by psychoses alone.
It's the car, right? Chicks love the car.
Batman is one of those films where they just go all out as far as the set designs, and the costumes are just the most elaborate costumes you've ever seen. And it's just this big, huge, you know, commercial film, and it's just kind of right up Joel's alley. I mean, he's got very specific tastes and very, you know, definite opinions about things. And when you get on a film that's this big, you need someone that has an opinion that will make a decision, you know, that isn't going to hem and haw over what you should do.
What do you suggest, Alfred? By sea? Or by air?
Why not both?
Who's your tailor?
It's just a great character because it's. I mean, he starts out, you know, pretty much bonkers to begin with, but it just takes on different forms, and he gets so full of, you know, just energy and evil power that, you know, you just can't help but love playing that.
This is your brain on the box. This is my brain on the box. Does anybody else feel like a fried egg?
I have a bit more, thank you.
Oh, there's more. But only the first one's free. Here's the bargain. You will help me steal production capital so I can put a box on every TV in town and become Gotham's cleverest carbon-based life form. And in return, is everybody paying attention? I will help you solve the greatest riddle of all, the mother of all riddles. Who is Batman?
I think part of what's great about being Batman is it's a very sexy character. And I did not feel that the Batman suits were sexy enough. So I set Bob Ringwood and Jose, who's the great sculptor who made them, into making extremely aggressively sexual male costumes. I only put the nipples on because they're part of the anatomy. I had no idea that I would be doing worldwide press over why there were nipples on the bat suit. I didn't think people would notice that much. I don't know why. Do you know why that was a source of controversy?
The costume was as uncomfortable as it was, you know, when you saw yourself in the mirror, you looked at yourself, you're like, you know, superhero, you know, it's a pretty cool thing. You know, of course, there are always comments made about the cod piece and the nipples in the suit and stuff. And to tell you the truth, I never even thought about that kind of stuff until we started doing press for the movie and it was in all these magazines. And, you know, once one question comes up, every other interviewer asks you about it. And I always loved hearing Joel do interviews about it, because, you know, just about the cod pieces and the nipples and the, you know, is there like a homosexual relationship between Batman and Robin? And Joel's always, you know, saying, oh, you know, it's so funny because it's actually Batman and Alfred where the relationship is.
I got geniuses to come and help me make a Batman movie. John Dykstra, who is a special effects genius. Barbara Ling, who is my favorite production designer. I had done Falling Down with her. Bob Ringwood and Ingrid Ferrin to do the costumes. Elliot Goldenthal, my favorite composer, to do the music. You know, the exciting thing about Batman is because all of the departments know they can show off in a Batman movie, sometimes the greatest work, for instance, in a movie like A Time to Kill, sometimes the greatest artistic work is invisible because it seems like real life. So you don't notice what someone has done because it's invisible. In a Batman movie, everyone gets to show off. So it attracts enormously gifted and brilliant artists and special effects geniuses, and so they make me look good. Making Batman is the most fun. It's a flight of fancy and fantasy, and you can let your imagination soar. It attracts fantastically talented people in front of the camera and behind the camera. I had no idea Batman Forever would be as successful as it was. Thank you, God.
In 1996, Schumacher turned once again to John Grisham's writing with the production of A Time to Kill, starring Matthew McConaughey, Sandra Bullock, Kevin Spacey, and Samuel L. Jackson. Roger Ebert wrote, "This is the best of the film versions of Grisham's novels and has been directed with skill by Joel Schumacher." But it was only after a private dinner with Grisham and his wife, Renee, that Joel was able to convince Grisham to allow his first novel to be made into a film.
Mr. Haley, just before you stepped outside of yourself and watched yourself shooting Mr. Willard and Mr. Cobb, were you aware that if convicted, they might be free in only 10 years?
Yes, sir. I heard Pete say that, yes, sir.
Do you think that two men who kidnap a child should be free in 10 years?
No, sir.
Do you think two men who rape a child should be free in 10 years?
No, sir.
Do you think two men who hang a child should be free in 10 years?
No, sir.
Well, what do you think should happen to them? What would be a fair sentence?
Objection,
do you think
Your
they
Honor.
Deserve to die, Mr. Haley? Answer the question.
Carly, don't answer that question.
To die. Yes, they deserve to die, and I hope they burn in hell.
A Time to Kill is John's best novel. And he always said he didn't want to make it made into a movie. And I asked him at that dinner if he would allow me to make it. And then he and Renee went through 25 reasons why they didn't want it made. And I tried to address each one, but of course, in the long run, when people have 25 reasons why they don't want to make something, it's his book. But then I took the client down to show him after it was finished, and we started talking about making A Time to Kill as a movie. So I think he was probably waiting to see the client until he made up his mind.
I need to talk to Jake Brigantz.
He's not in. May I ask who's calling?
Mickey Mouse.
Who?
Mickey Mouse. Get out right now.
Who is this?
Get your daughter out of the house right now.
I don't think I'm a great director. I don't think I'm touched by the gods and, you know, sprung full-blown out of the head of Minerva and as a genius. I know a couple of geniuses. I'm not one of them. I had an extraordinary cast. All of the actors in A Time to Kill did not need a job. They chose those roles over many others that they could have taken. Some of them took small roles. Sandra Bullock took a much smaller role than she had been offered in the last few years.
Kevin Spacey was about to get the Academy Award.
I think the same thing that Joel does in rehearsal is what he does on the set, which is that he creates an environment for a company, not just actors, but an entire crew. And that environment is of a very protective nature and a very fun nature. I mean, he's really he's a gas to be with. And anyone who sort of takes the seriousness out of the equation and allows us to remember that it's just a movie, and you know, we're all there to contribute to it in whatever way we've been asked to, you sort of feel very much like you're a member of a family.
Blacks are more sympathetic to the blacks. If he gets it moved, he has a greater chance of color in the jury box, and we know what that means. If the trial stays here, it's an all-white jury for sure. Now, Taylor, this is for you to integrate your brain with before 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon.
Yes. He means without blacks on the jury, Haley hasn't got a chance in hell.
All right, noose is up for re-elect.
Yeah, November.
Good. Reach out to our friends in the legislature. Have them call on Judge Noose. We're just going to help him decide to keep this case in Canton. Also, send a case of whatever it is he's drinking these days to Lucian Wheelbanks.
I believe that's Dewar's.
I don't want to keep that old drunk on the sidelines.
Yeah, Becca, get me, Sam.
And gentlemen, no mistakes.
I think the material touched the actors, too. They obviously wanted to play those characters, or they wouldn't have been down in 100-degree weather in Canton, Mississippi, if they didn't want to be. And then, I think everything was made better because of my choice of Matthew McConaughey in the lead. Because not only was Matthew the perfect choice for the movie, but I think his integrity, his character, his charm, his work ethic, his humanity stimulated all of the other actors in the piece, because I think they wanted Matthew to do well too. John and I had co-approval over that role, and if John didn't approve it, I couldn't have put Matthew in, so I'm glad that John was able to see it also.
Yeah. Look, I've played a gopher for 7 capital murder cases. I've witnessed 2 executions. I've written briefs for the ACLU. I'm top 5% of my class. I'm editor of the Law Review. I'm published. I am young, and when I graduate, I intend to spend a glorious career stomping out the death penalty. Let's see what else. Oh, genius runs in my family. So see, he'll be getting me on the way up, and I really think, you know, now is a good time to, you know, grab me.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else I should know?
Let's see, anything else. My father's filthy rich, so I'll be working for free. What do you think?
Aside from the great story and the incredible cast, and some of the very moving moments in the making of it, the experience of living with that town and those people, I will never forget as long as I live. And I was just talking to Sandra Bullock and Matthew McConaughey the other day, and we were saying, you know, if God is willing, we may all make a lot of movies, but it's never going to be like that again, ever. And it won't be, because, well, it's always very hard to repeat any experience, but that was very, 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 very unique and very moving on all kinds of levels.
In 1997, Schumacher brought to the screen yet another installment in the incredibly successful Batman series with Batman and Robin, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, George Clooney, Chris O'Donnell, and Alicia Silverstone. The question, of course, was how he would top himself after the success of Batman Forever.
There's always pressure on something with a high profile. Especially with the success of Batman Forever, I think people expect us to be successful now. See, with Batman Forever, I think we were saying, hey, we're the new kids on the block, take a chance on us. Now I think people expect us to be successful. That's an added pressure, but a sweet pressure in a way. I've had so much success with new actors. I found this big Austrian bodybuilder, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and I'm going to give him a break in the Batman movie.
I didn't really think much about it until Joel Schumacher came to me and said that he would like me to play Mr. Freeze, and gave me some of the comic books, gave me some of the old videotapes with Otto Preminger being, you know, the Mr. Freeze in this TV series, this black and white TV series. I looked at those. I found them extremely interesting and entertaining. And I thought, and I saw myself immediately as Mr. Freeze.
Arnold is a great bad guy. He's, well, he was a bad guy in Terminator. He is very funny and very scary in Batman and Robin. And Arnold has a chance to do a lot of dimensions with this one character. And he and Uma Thurman team up, and they're very funny together. Very wicked and very funny.
If I must suffer, humanity will suffer with me. I shall repay them for sentencing me to a life without the warmth of human comfort. I will blanket the city in endless winter. First, Gotham. And then, the world.
Just what I had in mind. Everything dead on Earth except us. A chance for Mother Nature to start again.
To be a Batman villain is like, in the movies, in a comic pop kind of way, it's sort of like an opera part. You know, it's limitless. Someone said to me, you can't be too big and you can't be too small. And I'm sure you can, but there is just, it's the opportunities are endless with the characters. And so it was just tempting. I've never done anything like it, and it doesn't come by very often. Joel is there to be the guardian of making sure that what you're doing is appropriate and beneficial to the movie as a whole. So, and he did that wonderfully. I had a great time with him that way.
He creates a set where everybody's very happy and all the crew is very, very happy. And that makes a huge difference when you can look behind the camera and or just when you're walking anywhere with anyone and everybody seems to be having a good time and enjoys what they're doing. And, you know, the good thing was, like, Chris and George, they both are making jokes with the guys all the time, and they had these relationships, and I can be a little bit too serious sometimes, so I don't...